So, I'd like to start by saying, on a personal level, thank you for bringing those spaces into my day, in actual fact. One of the things that I think, and I'm obviously not going to try and, it seems to me a bit of a question and answer thing. I'd rather say some things and see you to respond rather than to go with the, you can do differently, of course, but to go with your approach in a way. But it seems to me one of the things that's really strongly in what you're saying is the sort of the importance of the space of improvisation that doesn't talk about a sort of prescriptive intention.
Yeah, it's about, I think it's about flux is one thing, fluidity, and getting beyond certain ways of thinking, categories of thinking, if you like. And I think at the heart of my practice, whatever it is I do, whether I'm curating an exhibition or writing a book or creating an album through digital means, the improvisation is at the heart of that. And I've always been an improviser. I still am. I've just written a book on improvisation, the first volume of a 2-volume book on improvisation. And that to me is where the work, well, actually, I take that back. It's one of the places where the work comes from. I mean, the work comes from all kinds of murky places, actually, some of which we don't like to talk about. But the process through which the work emerges, I think, is an improvisation process. And I actually teach improvisation at London College of Communication. I do it every year. I've done it every year for, I'm in the 11th year of teaching it now. And it's always an amazing process because a class comes beginning of January, mix of undergraduates, MA students, and they don't know what they're doing with it. And by about the third week, I mean, this Monday I had the third week, something magical starts to happen where they begin to understand how material can emerge without intention and how that material can work in this collective context of the group. So how they can make a group sound together without any instruction or without any rules or whatever. And that to me is an incredibly powerful means of making work. You know, so when I sit down to write a book, sure, I have some kind of plan, vague plan, but it's about engagement with the materials and it's about allowing yourself to go into a kind of trance almost to produce something that then is interesting to read and has a kind of structure. You know, it's not just formless. I'm very interested in, I've been reading an author called Dorothy Miller Richardson. I don't know, have any of you heard of Dorothy Richardson? No? She was a pioneer of stream of consciousness writing, what we call stream of consciousness. So she was born in the 19th century. She had a very tough life. Her father lost all the family money. Her mother committed suicide more or less in front of her. When she was very young, 17 or something, 16, 17, she had to go to Germany to work as like a governess in a school, all on her own. And she started to write these books, which were supposedly fiction. They're about a woman called Miriam. But Miriam, every stage of the books, and there are many of these books, every stage of the books corresponds to her life, Dorothy Richardson's life. So, and they were written at the beginning of the 20th century, but she used a lot of very kind of avant-garde punctuation, and she talked a lot about herself in a, you know, a very deep psychological way, which was a new thing then. And it's amazing stuff. I mean, can I read you something?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the time you get the sense that she's quite isolated from people, and she's really, a lot of the time she's really pissed off with people. She's just like angry. And but she goes through these incredible episodes of ecstasy almost. You know, it's like, I mean, a lot of what she says is attacking religion. But then she has these moments. I mean, there's one from her first book. This is when she was a teenager working in Germany. It was everywhere, in the food, in the fragrance rising from the open lid of the tea urn, in all the needful, unquestioned movements, the requests, the thanks and handings, the going from room to room, the parting and assemblings. At rare moments, there would come a tingling from head to foot, a faint buzzing at her lips and at the tip of each finger. So, I mean, this reminds me of those YouTube ASMR videos, you know, where people talk about crumpling paper and getting this tingle. But she's feeling these incredible moments of ecstasy, and she's using language to express this kind of breakthrough, you know, through different categories of experience into something that is, that in a way feels much more modern, you know. And she predated Virginia Woolf, and her first book was published around the same time as James Joyce's Portrait of an Artist. So she's a kind of unsung pioneer of this stream of consciousness idea, where everything inside you is allowed to come out by some channel or other. And for me, there's a strong relationship between improvisation and this process of trying to find a fluidity between materials and substances and categories of experience. And so if I sit down here and talk to you, I just bring stuff, and I don't prepare it, and I'm prepared to accept that you could be bored by it, you don't know what I'm talking about, it may be completely incoherent, it may not make any sense either to you or to me, but it attempts something that other frameworks, other formats through which we try to communicate ideas to each other don't. So, yeah, I mean, you're right. Improvisation is very important to me.
Lovely, thank you. I have a few other things, but I'm going to open it up first, and then hopefully I'll still be able to get my comments in.
I'm interested to ask how ritual and shamanism works in your work. Like, I heard that word at the beginning, and I was interested in what you've looked into that area about.
Yeah, the reference was to a record which was released last year called Lost Shadows, which was recordings I made in 1978 in southern Venezuela of Yanomami shamanism. And they'd been released before, but this was like a more full release with all the photos and more recordings, and I wrote a really long essay. So that was the reference. But I was interested from, I guess, my early 20s. I got interested because the question in my mind was, what is music for? Is it just like a consumerist, escapist kind of diversion? You know, is it just kind of totally bound up in capitalism where we're just selling stuff and people think, oh, this is nice, or that's horrible, or, you know. And what about performances? You know, are they just completely formulaic? Or can we reach something that is more deep, you know, more meaningful. So that was my question. And, you know, I was very young and I was working in this kind of free rock band and then in free improvisation, playing guitar and stuff. And I came across material on shamanism. And it seemed to me that what I was reading there was about a way of a functionality for music that went deeper than this consumerist, escapist idea. That, you know, it was very much embedded in mythological ideas, but in functioning societies, you know, and it had a purpose, and there were very interesting aspects to the way sound was used in that setting that you couldn't necessarily describe as music if you used the definitions of music that were current at that time and, you know, considered valid. So I began to study it, and I began to study it in some depth, and then I thought, well, I want to do more than read books. So I met a guy who was Venezuelan, and we talked about this possibility of the Yanomami. And so in 1978, he'd gone back to Venezuela, and he was living there with his partner, who was a French woman, who was a photographer. And so I went to Venezuela, and we went into Amazonas and managed to record some of these situations of this group shamanism among the Yanomami, taking this very strong hallucinogenic drug that comes from tree bark, and it becomes very extreme. The Yanomami don't have instruments, musical instruments. They don't make musical instruments. They're almost unique in that sense. So everything is vocal. And it's very, very extreme. Somebody said to me recently, I've been banned from playing your Yanomami record in the house, you know, because it's... And I had a really... interesting experience. I was watching, do any of you know a film called The Road, based on a Cormac McCarthy novel? I was watching the film of The Road, and I was sort of bored by the film. I didn't really think it was that great. But there's a scene, sorry if this is a spoiler, but there's a scene which is kind of horrific, really, where the father, who's going around with his son trying to survive, they find a property in which people seem to be living, and they go down into the basement, and they find that people are being kept captive there specifically for the purpose of being eaten. So it's like people farming. So it's a really grotesque idea, very disturbing. The music for the film was done by Nick Cave. But at the point where he goes down into this basement, and you suddenly realize that these people are, you know, a kind of cannibal farm, they used one of my Yanomami recordings, without permission, I have to say. So it's stolen. They used one of my Yanomami recordings of a shaman screaming. And it was as if you could only convey the horror. It was as if you could only convey the horror. I'll say that again. The horror of this appalling scene with this vocal music. I mean, it was doubly shocking to me because they'd stolen my sound, you know, and that was... So, yeah, that that in a nutshell is my interest. Yeah.
There's a certain fear in letting go of your intellect or your thought processes, at least for a time. Because when you play that song, the African voices, because to me I can easily tell we're African.
Yeah.
But I've written down here, because before you mentioned anything, and an elephant died. It sounded to me like something was dying.
Uh-huh.
But for some reason, an elephant. And I thought about being poached. No.
Yeah.
Where does that come from?
Yeah.
I'm not looking for an answer. But in that space where that arrived, or grew in this thing for me to write it down,
yeah.
Do you think loads of hallucinogenic drugs kind of change something, change your perception, even later on in life if you don't take any? I kind of know this from experience. But it's almost, if I can go back a little bit to 14th century or something, was a mystical book written. The main phrase in it was, these things can never be found by the intellect, but by the heart alone.
Mm.
So that place in there between mind and heart and feeling, kind is what I get from things that you're saying, although you're producing things from that.
Mm-hmm.
So, I forgot.
But the point you're making is very interesting, and I think this idea of the unspeakable is kind of a key to it for me. I've always felt divided, as I said earlier, between this analytical self who is able to write and be a critic and write essays, and I've worked as a journalist in the past. I worked as a music journalist for 10 years. You know, and I was always the guy at the gigs who was thinking about the music. Even if I got drunk, you know, I was still thinking about the music. What's going on? And that really annoyed me. You know, why can't I just totally let go? And in a way, a lot of my life has been about trying to reconcile these two extremes. One is being analytical and being able to verbalize and articulate all of these ideas, and the other is working in improvisation and working with the unspeakable. And I think, you know, in recent years I've tried to get these two sides of myself to make friends in a way, and this is where, you know, your theme comes in, where art happens, to kind of work in the thin paper, tissue paper, thin space between these worlds, but to be able to move fluidly between them, and using materials and using actions and also using words, I feel it's a way of coming closer. The drugs bit is, you know, I've never been a particularly druggy person. I mean, I've taken my fair share of drugs, and I've certainly, God knows, drunk enough alcohol in my life, but I don't do any of that anymore, you know, and I don't need to, because, you know, it's done and it's remembered. To me, it's much more interesting to come and, you know, just sit here and try to make something happen that makes people think in a slightly different way.
I agree with that. And the name of the book I was trying to remember is The Cloud of Unknowing.
Cloud of Unknowing, yes. Very famous book. Yeah. And The Cloud of Unknowing is so appropriate to, you know, certainly appropriate to a lot of music, you know, which seems to operate in a cloud of unknowing. And is very hard to talk about, in fact. But all kinds of experiences, you know, this experience of Dorothy Richardson I just read out, you know, one of the things that's great about her is that she was able to find a form of writing at the very beginning of the 20th century that somehow communicated the experience of, you know, this... what do we call them? I don't know. They're just experiences out of the ordinary, I suppose. And we all have them, but we all deal with them in different ways.
I have a little question. It's about the point between knowing and unknowing. You talk about that being in that state of its improvisation, and when you brought a set, you may not have known quite what you would do, but you chose a set of things to bring. And of course, you will also go towards eventually finished pieces of work or recordings or pieces of writing. So you go to a point of ordering or decision or collecting.
Yeah.
And I'm quite interested in that, how you stop yourself getting there too quickly, or how you, you know, because it's very easy to start to know too much, isn't there? Trying to keep that space.
I think writing a book, or actually writing anything. That question of timing is really important. That in a way it's, I tend to say this with students, you know, who get stuck, that basically it's always like that. But suddenly, you know, the stopper can come out and then the material flows too quickly and you can't be in control of it. Because then in the end you know that you're trying to make something that's finished, a kind of object. You know, whether it be a book or an essay or, you know, just 500 words or something about something. And you know that the material is there. I know that the material is there. But it's how to allow it to come out and how to allow it to come out at the right pace. And it's no different to sitting here and thinking, okay, I've just got my stuff in the same way I would have my stuff if I was playing a music gig. You know, I'd have instruments and what have you, but I don't know what I'm going to do with them. And there's a kind of anxiety, a necessary anxiety that goes with that. That this could be the time when you find nothing to say. So I could sit here like an idiot and just, sorry, it's not happening. Or I could assume that it's in me, and the important process is just allowing it, you know, kind of almost giving it permission to emerge, but at the right pace, you know. And with writing, that is so difficult, particularly writing a book, because it's a massive struggle to begin, it's a massive struggle to get going, but then it's all coming too fast. And you can't keep up with it, so you have to use various strategies to slow it down. And you know, I think these elemental principles, if you like, are the key to doing any kind of work, you know. So anybody among you who thinks this isn't relevant to me, you know, you're wrong, because it's a way of making work, any kind of work.
It's just to reiterate that, it's the point of not knowing too much, doesn't it? Without confidence, it's very easy as a younger artist to want to get to the place of more certainty. And you're talking about coming in that, and you'd have the confidence to think, well, it will be there on the line.
Yeah, but I think it's important to be unsettled at any stage. I mean, I was saying this earlier, I did two quick tutorials, and I said this in the first one, that just as it's important to have confidence, it's also important to unsettle yourself, you know, when you're beginning. But it's maybe even more important to unsettle yourself when you're my age. You know, otherwise you're really going to go downhill. You know, you have to put yourselves in self in situations of risk. You know, you have to put yourself in situations where you don't know what you're doing, or where you could look stupid, or where you could be found out for not knowing enough. All of these things that unsettle your any kind of fixed identity about who you are and what you know. And I'm constantly staggered about what I don't know, you know. I mean, I know a lot about music. And I say that without showing off, you know, I know a lot about music, but there's a huge amount I don't know. And, you know, that's always there to be learned. So you begin any major project by thinking, I don't know enough. And it's very scary. And then after a certain time you think, well, I probably actually know too much. And you know, then you have a problem of compression, that you can end up so tightly compressing a huge amount of information that it's basically unreadable, or it can't be absorbed. And so, you know, it's finding a balance.
So are you a lot more comfortable with the drawings which are made through sound rather than the drawings which you've made yourself, made through Marx?
Yeah, I think the drawings I made by myself through Marx are rubbish.
Would you be more sort of happy showing the pieces which are made through sound?
Then? Yeah, definitely. Yeah. The others just go in the bin. One of the things I've been doing is semi-destroying them and then photographing them. And that kind of works. But if I come back to making the marks, I don't know why it is. You know, it's a mystery to me. I mean, I realize you can lose the facility to do something over time. But the question of why, you know, what happens, what that is really, really intriguing. Because then it's a question of what's happening when it's working. You know, in whatever you do, whatever your skill is, why is it working suddenly and then not working? And why can't you get it back? And one of the things I think is that I just switch my focus from seeing to hearing very dramatically in my 20s. And then a lot of the focus of my life has been to do with hearing, listening, making music. And so it's something to do with the eye, the hand and the eye. But I don't know. It's a puzzle. But I occasionally keep some drawings. And then I go back and look at them and I think, no, that's rubbish, and throw it away. But I'm totally happy with the ones that are made by other means.
Every time? Sort of, you're happy every time? Do you ever think, oh no, that's rubbish, to throw that away?
Yeah, sometimes, yeah, sometimes they don't work. I mean, there's a history of this, you know, and you can go back to the Gutai artists in Japan at the beginning of the 1960s who were interested in these automatic processes or action, and they tended to there was an artist called Atsuko Hasegawa, and she made a piece called Bell, which is really a pioneering sound art piece. It's just bells around the edges of a room, electric bells, and you as a visitor to a gallery can press a button and sound the bells. And she called that a painting. But then you can go back to Jackson Pollock, obviously, and Pollock painting flat on the ground, and he did a series, I think in the same year that he started painting with the canvas flat, he did a series called Sounds in the Grass. So he was obviously thinking about physically moving through the work, and physical gesture making marks, and there being some correlation between this mark making and this movement and listening, which I find kind of interesting. And as a side thing, Pollock was very influenced by Navajo sand painting that he saw in New York a few years before he started this process of painting with the canvas flat on the ground. And the sand paintings, of course, would have been done in conjunction with music, with singing and drumming in, you know, Navajo rituals. So, you know, that correlation was always there. It kind of goes back to what I was saying to you. You know, this meaningful interlinking of stuff so that it's just not selling things, you know. It's more embedded in that way.
Do we have a few more minutes?
I kind of like this humming silence.
Just take one more question.
Off the back of Chelsea's question, does it come back to some sort of ownership of the work? Because if you're making your own instruments to then create something else,
yeah,
does that mean you don't necessarily, you will be critiqued on it because it's not something you produced?
Yeah.
And if you're a music journalist, then you've done, I assume, critiquing other people's work and their ability to play instruments, then you're kind of distancing yourself a little bit from what you're creating, in a way.
Yeah, it's two really interesting questions. I mean, the first one, ownership, is such a huge question now, I think. But that's obviously one of the key aspects of improvisation. If you're working collectively without a composer or without somebody producing some sort of score or instruction, then it's collectively made and collectively owned. And you can go back to the 1950s and find a kind of point of tension where you see the beginnings of this kind of music, but they fit within the copyright law. You know, so they're often ascribed to a single composer, usually the leader of the group. And thinking about my collaborations with Rie Nakajima, there is a really strong issue of ownership. Like, for instance, I'd been thinking for years about working with vibration motors to produce sound, but I'm so hopeless technically in this kind of area that I sort of did things like thought about Arduinos and bought various vibration motors and what have you, but could never figure them out. And everybody I talked to was so kind of nerdy about the whole thing that it put me off. But then I met Rie, and she was working with these, and she's very practical about the way she makes them, and she just gave me this one, you know, which has become quite important to me. It's just a way of working with stuff. And so it raises this question of what belongs to who? And then if we make collaborative drawings, whose is it? And I think our answer to that is that we have kind of boundaries which are recognized through respect, you know, that this is somebody's area and we don't overstep it, but there's an area of overlap in which we feel completely free to borrow each other's stuff and to work with each other's ideas and to produce works which don't really actually have an owner, you know, they're just collectively made. And I like that situation. You know, it's to me, it's very productive, and it moves away from copyright law and stuff like that. You know, where everybody's saying this is my stuff, and it's cut off from everybody else. The second question is a bit less clear, I think, to me, and it's about being a critic. Yeah.
Yeah, just kind of removing yourself from the noises that you've created, that no one can really judge. So no one can say, oh, you played that balloon wrong.
Yes, exactly, yes.
No one has the standard already set, so you've kind of set in your own, going, this is a noise I've made.
Yeah.
You've got to, this is what it is.
But, you know, it's a funny thing. You could find somebody else working with a balloon, and you would be able to say, that's not very good. And which is not to say that what I did was great, but, you know, you could say, they're not doing that very well. And I think you can find a certain kind of standard for any activity at all. You know, the music that interested me from being a teenager was often people playing instruments in unconventional ways. And to give you an example, I discovered a saxophone player called Ornette Coleman when I was a young teenager, who had kind of revolutionized jazz. And I heard a story recently. He played saxophone for a film score of a film called Naked Lunch, which was based on the William Burroughs book. And the story is that he played with an orchestra, and they said, you're playing a semitone sharp. Now, people had said this about him all his life. And he said, I can play exactly in tune, but it won't sound like me. So who's to say that's wrong? You have one of the most identifiable saxophone, I mean, he died last year, but one of the most identifiable saxophone players in the world. Technically, what he's doing is wrong. But if you made him do it technically right, then he wouldn't be interesting in the same way. And I think you can extrapolate from that. You can, I mean, you know, these, going back to these drawings, throwing away drawings, who's to say they're not brilliant? I mean, they're not brilliant, but, you know, my judgment of them, and I'm not an art historian, but my judgment of them based on experience is that they're no good, or at least they don't satisfy my standards, my personal standards. So, you know, these are very difficult areas that we negotiate, because the thing about art now is that you can do anything with any materials, and it can be art. I mean, you know that from looking at what artists do. So this question of evaluating is kind of on a case-by-case basis, and it's about using your experience and your knowledge and a whole cluster of different elements to make a judgment about work. Yeah. And it's not at all easy.
I think we'll have to leave it there.
Thank you.
Thank you, David.